Lobsang paused at the foot of a staircase, half hidden behind a luckless elephant. A red rope, now hard as a bar, suggested that this wasn't part of the public museum. There was an added hint in the shape of a notice saying, "Absolutely no admittance." "I should be up there," he said. "Let's not hang around then, eh?" said Susan, leaping over the rope. The narrow stairs led up onto a large, bare landing. Boxes were stacked here and there. "The attics," said Susan. "Hold on, what's that sign for?" "Keep left," Lobsang read. "Well, if they have to move heavy items around." "Look at the sign, will you?" said Susan. "Don't see what you expect to see. See what's in front of you." Lobsang looked. The sign, although saying "keep left," pointed to the right. "What a stupid sign," he said. "Interesting, certainly," said Susan. "Which way do you think we should go? I don't think it'll take them too long to decide to follow us." "We're so close. Any passage might do," said Lobsang. "Any passage it is, then." Susan headed for a narrow gap between packing cases. Lobsang followed. "What do you mean, decide?" he said, as they entered the gloom. "The sign on the stairs said there was no admittance."
"You mean they'll disobey it?"
he stopped. "Eventually. But they'll have a terrible feeling that they ought not to. They obey rules. They are the rules, in a way."
"But you can't obey the keep left right sign, no matter what you do."
Oh, I see. Isn't learning fun? Oh, and here's another one. Do not feed the elephant.
Now that, said Susan, is good.
You can't obey it because there's no elephant, said Lobsang. I think I'm getting the hang of this.
It's an auditor trap, said Susan, peering at a packing case.
Here's another good one, said Lobsang. Ignore this sign by order.
Nice touch, Susan agreed. But I'm wondering, who put up the signs?
There were voices somewhere behind them. They were low, but then one was suddenly raised.
Says left, but points right. It has no sense. The fault is yours. We disobeyed the first sign. Woe to them that stray onto the pathway of irregularity.
Don't you give me that, you organic thing. I raise my voice at you. You...
There was a soft sound, a choking noise, and a scream that dopplered into nothing.
Are they fighting one another? Said Lobsang.
We can only hope so. Let's move, said Susan. They crept on, weaving through the maze of spaces between the crates, and passed a sign saying, duck.
Ah, now we're getting metaphysical, said Susan.
Why duck? Said Lobsang.
Why, indeed.
Somewhere amongst the cases, a voice reached the end of its tether.
What organic damn elephant? Where is the elephant?
There is no elephant.
How can there be a sign, then?
It is a...
And once again the little choke and the vanishing scream, and then running footsteps. Susan and Lobsang backed into the shadows, and then Susan said,
What have I put my foot in?
She reached down and picked up the soft, sticky mess, and as she rose, she saw the auditor come round the corner. It was wild-eyed and frantic. It focused on the pair of them with difficulty, as if trying to remember who and what they were, but it was holding a sword and holding it correctly. A figure rose up behind it. One hand grabbed it by the hair and jerked its head back. The other was thrust over its open mouth. The auditor struggled for a moment and then went rigid, and then disintegrated, tiny particles spinning away and disappearing into nothing. For a moment, the last few handfuls tried to form in the air the shape of a small cowled figure. Then it too was dragged apart with a faint scream that was heard via the hairs on the back of the neck. Susan glared at the figure in front of her.
You can't be a... What are you? She demanded.
The figure was silent. This might have been because thick cloth covered its nose and mouth. Heavy gloves encased its hands. And this was odd because most of the rest of it was wearing a sequined evening gown and a mink stole and a knapsack and a huge picture hat with enough feathers to make three rare species totally extinct. The figure rummaged in the knapsack and then thrust out a piece of dark brown paper, as if proffering holy writ. Lobsang took it with care.
It says here, Higgs and Meekin's Luxury Assortment, he said. Caramel Crunch, Hazelnut Surprise, they're chocolates.
Susan opened her hand and looked at the crushed strawberry whirl she had picked up. She gave the figure a careful look.
"How did you know that would work?" she said. "Please, you have nothing to fear from me," said the muffled voice of the bandages. "I'm down to the ones with the nuts in now, and they don't melt very quickly."
"Sorry," said Lobsang. "You just killed an auditor with a chocolate."
"My last orange cream, yes. We are exposed here. Come with me."
"An auditor," Susan breathed. "You're an auditor, too, aren't you? Why should I trust you?"
"There isn't anyone else."
"But you are one of them," said Susan. "I can tell, even under all that stuff."
"I was one of them," said Lady Lejean. "Now I rather think I'm one of me."
People were living in the attic. There was a whole family up there. Susan wondered if their presence was official or unofficial, or one of those in-between states that were so common in Ankh-Morpork, where there was always a chronic housing shortage. So much of the city's life took place on the street because there was no room for it inside. Whole families were raised in shifts, so that the bed could be used for 24 hours a day. By the look of it, the caretakers and men who knew the way to Caravati's three large pink women and one piece of gauze had moved their families into the rambling attics. The rescuer had simply moved in on top of them. A family, or at least one shift of it, was seated on benches around a table, frozen in timelessness. Lady Lejean removed her hat, hung it on the mother, and shook out her hair. Then she unwrapped the heavy bandages from her nose and mouth.
"We are relatively safe here," she said. "They are mostly in the main streets. Good day. My name is Myria Lejean. I know who you are, Susan Stowe Herrett. I do not know the young man, which surprises me. I take it you are here to destroy the clock?"
"To stop it," said Lobsang.
Hold on, said Susan. "This makes no sense. Auditors hate everything about life, and you are an auditor, aren't you?" "I have no idea what I am," sighed Lady Lejean. "But right now I know that I am everything an auditor should not be. We have to be stopped."
"With chocolate," said Susan.
"The sense of taste is new to us. Alien, we have no defences."
"But chocolate?"
"A dry biscuit almost killed me," said her ladyship. "Susan, can you imagine what it is like to experience taste for the first time? We built our bodies well, oh yes. Lots of taste buds. Even water is like wine. But chocolate? Even the mind stops. There is nothing but the taste," she sighed. "I imagine it is a wonderful way to die."
"It doesn't seem to affect you," said Susan suspiciously.
"The bandages and the gloves," said Lady Lejean. "Even then, it is all I can do not to give in. Oh, where are my manners? Do sit down, pull up a small child."
Lobsang and Susan exchanged a glance. Lady Lejean noticed it.
"I said something wrong," she said.
"We don't use people as furniture," said Susan.
"But surely they will not be aware of it," said her ladyship.
"We will," said Lobsang. "That's the point, really."
"Ah, I have so much to learn. There is so much context to being human, I'm afraid. You, sir, can you stop the clock?"
"I don't know how to," said Lobsang. "But I think I should know. I'll try."
"Would the clockmaker know? He is here."
"Where?" said Susan.
"Just down the passage," said Lady Lejean.
"You carried him here?"
"He was barely able to walk. He was badly hurt in the fight."
"What?" said Lobsang. "How could he walk at all? We're outside time."
Susan took a deep breath.
"He carries his own time just like you," she said. "He's your brother."
And it was a lie. But he wasn't ready for the truth. By the look on his face, he wasn't even ready for the lie.
"Twins," said Mrs. Ogg.
She picked up the brandy glass, looked at it, and put it down.
"There wasn't one, there was twins. Two boys, but..."
She turned on Susan a glare like a thermic lance.
"You'll be thinking, this is an old biddy of a midwife," she said. "You'll be thinking, what does she know?"
Susan paid her the courtesy of not lying.
"Part of me was," she admitted. "Good answer. Part of us thinks all kinds of things," said Mrs. Ogg. "Part of me is thinking, who's this haughty little miss who talks to me as if I was a kiddie of five?
but most of me is thinking she's got a heap of troubles of her own and has seen plenty of things a human shouldn't have to see. Mind you, part of me says so have I. Seeing things a human shouldn't have to see makes us human.
Well, miss, if you've any sense, part of you is thinking there's a witch in front of me who's seen my grandad many times when she's sat by a sickbed that suddenly become a deathbed, and she'll be ready to spit in his eye when the time comes, so she could probably bother me considerably right now if she puts her mind to it. Understand? Let's all keep our parts to ourselves.
And suddenly she gave Susan a wink, as the eye priest said to the actress.
I absolutely agree, said Susan. Completely.
Right, said Mrs. Ogg.
So, twins, well, it was her first time, and human wasn't exactly a familiar shape with her. I mean, you can't do what comes naturally when you ain't exactly natural, and twins ain't quite the right word.
A brother, said Lobsang, the clockmaker.
Yes, said Susan,
but I was a foundling.
So was he. I want to see him now.
That might not be a good idea, said Susan.
I am not interested in your opinion, thank you.
Lobsang turned to Lady Lejeune.
Down that passage.
Yes, but he's asleep. I think the clock upset his mind, and also he was hit in the fight. He says things in his sleep.
Says what?
The last thing I heard him say before I came to find you was, we're so close any passage might do, said her ladyship.
She looked from one to the other.
Have I said the wrong thing?
Susan put her hand over her eyes. Oh, dear.
I said that, said Lobsang, just after we came up the stairs.
He glared at Susan.
Twins, right? I've heard about this sort of thing. What one thinks the other thinks too.
Susan sighed.
Sometimes she thought, I really am a coward.
Something like that, yes, she said.
I'm going to see him then, even if he can't see me.
Damn, thought Susan, and hurried after Lobsang as he headed along the passage. The auditor trailed behind them, looking concerned. Jeremy was lying on a bed, although it was no softer than anything else in the timeless world. Lobsang stopped and stared.
He looks quite like me, he said.
Oh, yes, said Susan.
Thinner, perhaps.
Could be, yes.
Different lines on his face.
You've led different lives, said Susan.
How did you know about him and me?
My grandfather takes an interest in this sort of thing. I found out some more by myself, too, she said.
Why should we interest anyone? We're not special.
This is going to be quite hard to explain, Susan looked round at Lady Lejeune. How safe are we here?
The signs upset them, said her ladyship.
They tend to keep away. I, shall we say, took care of the ones who followed you.
Then you'd better sit down, Mr. Lobsang, said Susan. It might help if I told you about me.
Well?
My grandfather is death.
That's a strange thing to say. Death is just the end of life. It's not a person.
Pay attention to me when I am talking to you.
A wind whipped around the room and the lights changed. Shadows formed on Susan's face. A faint blue light outlined her. Lobsang swallowed. The light faded. The shadows vanished.
There is a process called death, and there is a person called death, said Susan.
That is how it works. And I am death's granddaughter. Am I going too fast for you?
No, although right up until just now you looked human, said Lobsang.
My parents were human. There's more than one kind of genetics.
Susan paused.
You look human too. Human is a very popular look in these parts. You'd be amazed.
Except that I am human.
Susan gave a little smile that, on anyone less obviously in full control of himself, might have seemed slightly nervous.
Yes, she said. And then again, no.
No?
Take war now, said Susan, backing away from the point. Big man, hearty laugh, tends to fart after meals.
As human as the next man, you'd say.
But the next man is death. He's human-shaped too. And that's because humans invented the idea of ideas. And they think in human shapes.
Get back to the and then again no, will you?
Your mother is time.
No one knows who my mother is.
I could take you to the midwife, said Susan.
Your father found the best there's ever been. She delivered you. Your mother was time. Lobsang sat with his mouth open. It was easier for me, said Susan. When I was very small, my parents used to let me visit my grandfather. I thought every grandfather had a long black robe and rode a pale horse. And then they decided that maybe that wasn't the right environment for a child. They were worried about how I was going to grow up. She laughed mirthlessly. I had a very strange education, you know. Maths, logic, that sort of thing. And then, when I was a bit younger than you, a rat turned up in my room and suddenly everything I thought I knew was wrong. I'm a human. I do human things. I'd know it if... You had to live in the world. Otherwise, how could you learn to be human? Said Susan, as kindly as she could. And my brother? What about him?
Here it comes, Susan thought.
He's not your brother, said Susan. I lied a bit, I'm sorry. But you said...
I had to lead up to it, said Susan.
It's one of those things you have to get hold of a bit at a time, I'm afraid. He's not your brother. He's you.
Then who am I?
Susan sighed.
You.
Both of you are you.
And there I was, and there she was, said Mrs. Ogg. And out the baby came, no problem there. But that's always a trying moment for the new mum. And there was...
She paused, her eyes peering through the windows of memory.
Like a feeling that the world had stuttered. And I was holding a baby. And I looked down, and there was me delivering a baby. And I looked at me, and I looked at me. And I remember saying, this is a fine to do, Mrs. Ogg. And she, it was me, said, you never said a truer word, Mrs. Ogg. Then it all went strange, and there I was, just one of me, holding two babies.
Twins, Susan said.
You could call them twins, yes, I suppose you could, said Mrs. Ogg. But I always thought that twins is two little souls born once, not one born twice.
Susan waited. Mrs. Ogg looked in the mood to talk.
So I said to the man, I said, what now? And he said, is that any business of yours? And I said he could be damn sure it was my business, and he could look me in the eye, and I'd speak my mind to anyone. But I was thinking, you're in trouble now, my girl, 'cause it had all gone mythic.
Mythic, said schoolteacher Susan.
Yep, with extra myth, and you can get into big trouble with mythic. But the man just smiled and said that he must be brought up human until he's of age, and I thought, yep, it's gone mythic all right. I could see he hadn't got a clue about what to do next, and it was all going to be down to me.
Mrs. Ogg took a suck at her pipe, and her eyes twinkled at Susan through the smoke.
I don't know how much experience you have with this sort of thing, my girl, but sometimes when the Iron Mighty make big plans, they don't always think about the fine detail, right?
Yes, I'm a fine detail, Susan thought. One day Death took it into his skull to adopt a motherless child, and I'm a fine detail. She nodded.
I thought, how does this go in a mythic kind of way? Mrs. Ogg went on. I mean, technically I could see that we're in that area where the prince gets brought up as a swineherd until he manifests his destiny. But there's not all that many swineherding jobs around these days, and poking hogs with a stick is not all it's cracked up to be, believe you me. So I said, well, I'd heard the guilds down in the big cities took in foundlings at a charity, and looked after them well enough, and there's many well-set-up men and women who started life that way. There is no shame in it. Plus, if the destiny doesn't manifest itself as per schedule, he'd have set his hands to a good trade, which would be a consolation. Whereas swineherding's just swineherding.
You're giving me a stern look, miss.
Well, yes. It was a rather chilly decision, wasn't it? Someone has to make 'em, said Mrs. Ogg sharply. Besides, I've been around for some time, and I've noticed that them as has it in 'em to shine will shine through six layers of muck, whereas those who ain't shiny won't shine however much you buff 'em. You may think otherwise, but it was me standing there.
She investigated the bowl of her pipe with a matchstick. Eventually, she went on,
and that was it. I would have stayed, of course, because there wasn't so much as a crib in the place, but the man took me aside and said, thank you, and it was time to go. And why should I argue? There was love there, it was in the air. But I won't say that I don't sometimes wonder how it all turned out. I really do.
There were differences, Susan had to admit. Two different lives had indeed burned their unique tracks on the faces, and the selves had been born a second or so apart, and a lot of the universe can change in a second. Think of identical twins, she told herself, but they are two different selves occupying bodies that at least start out identical. They don't start out as identical selves.
He looks quite like me, said Lobsang.
and Susan blinked. She leaned closer to the unconscious form of Jeremy.
"Say that again," she said.
"I said, he looks quite like me," said Lobsang. Susan glanced at Lady Lejeune, who said,
"I saw it too, Susan."
"Oh, so what?" said Lobsang. "What are you two hiding from me?"
"His lips move when you speak," said Susan. "They try to form the same words."
"He can pick up my thoughts."
"It's more complicated than that, I think."
Susan picked up a limp hand and gently pinched the web of skin between thumb and forefinger. Lobsang winced and glanced at his own hand. A patch of white skin was reddening again.
"Not just thoughts," said Susan. "This close, you feel his pain. Your speech controls his lips."
Lobsang stared down at Jeremy.
"Then what will happen," he said slowly,
"when he comes round?"
"I'm wondering the same thing," said Susan. "Perhaps you shouldn't be here."
"But this is where I have to be."
"We at least should not stay here," said Lady Lejeune. "I know my kind. They will have been discussing what to do. The signs will not hold them forever, and I have run out of soft centres."
"What are you supposed to do when you are where you're supposed to be?" said Susan. Lobsang reached down and touched Jeremy's hand with his fingertip. The world went white. Susan wondered later if this was what it would be like at the heart of a star. It wouldn't be yellow. You wouldn't see fire. There would just be the searing whiteness of every overloaded sense screaming all at once. It faded gradually into a mist. The walls of the room appeared, but she could see through them. There were other walls beyond, and other rooms, transparent as ice, and visible only at the corners and where the light caught them. In each one, another Susan was turning to look at her. The rooms went on forever. Susan was sensible. It was, she knew, a major character flaw. It did not make you popular or cheerful, and this seemed to her to be the most unfair bit. It didn't even make you right. But it did make you definite, and she was definite that what was happening around her was not, in any accepted sense, real. That was not in itself a problem. Most of the things humans busied themselves with weren't real, either. But sometimes the mind of the most sensible person encountered something so big, so complex, so alien to all understanding, that it told itself little stories about it instead. Then, when it felt it understood the story, it felt it understood the huge, incomprehensible thing. And this, Susan knew, was her mind telling itself a story. There was a sound like great heavy metal doors slamming, one after another, getting louder and faster. The universe reached a decision. The other glass rooms vanished, the walls clouded, colour rose pastel at first, then darkening as timeless reality flowed back. The bed was empty. Lobsang had gone. But the air was full of slivers of blue light, turning and swirling like ribbons in a storm. Susan remembered to breathe again. "Oh," she said aloud, "destiny." She turned. The bedraggled Lady Lejeune was still staring at the empty bed.
"Is there another way out of here?" "There's an elevator at the end of the corridor, Susan, but what happened to—"
"Not Susan," said Susan sharply. "It's Miss Susan. I'm only Susan to my friends, and you are not one of them. I don't trust you at all."
"I don't trust me either," said Lady Lejeune meekly. "Does that help?"
"Show me this elevator, will you?" It turned out to be nothing more than a large box the size of a small room, which hung from a web of ropes and pulleys in the ceiling. It had been installed recently, by the look of it, to move the large works of art around. Sliding doors occupied most of one wall.
"There are capstans in the cellar for winching it up," said Lady Lejeune. "Downward journeys are slowed safely because of a mechanism by which the weight of the descending elevator causes water to be pumped up into rainwater systems on the roof, which in turn can be released back into a hollow counterweight that assists in the elevation of heavier items of—"
"Thank you," said Susan quickly. "But what it really needs in order to descend is time."
Under her breath she added, "Can you help?" The ribbons of blue light orbited her like puppies anxious to play, and then drifted towards the elevator.
"However," she added, "I believe time is on our side now."
Miss Tangerine was amazed at how fast a body learned. Until now, auditors had learned by counting. Sooner or later, everything came down to numbers. if you knew all the numbers, you knew everything. Often the later was a lot later, but that did not matter, because for an auditor, time was just another number. But a brain, a few soggy pounds of gristle, counted numbers so fast that they stopped being numbers at all. She'd been astonished at how easily it could direct a hand to catch a ball in the air, calculating future positions of hand and ball without her even being aware of it. The senses seemed to operate and present her with conclusions before she had time to think. At the moment, she was trying to explain to other auditors that not feeding an elephant when there was no elephant not to feed was not, in fact, impossible. Miss Tangerine was one of the faster-learning auditors and had already formulated a group of things, events and situations that she categorised as bloody stupid. Things that were bloody stupid could be dismissed. Some of the others were having difficulty understanding this, but now she stopped in mid-harangue when she heard the rumble of the lift. "Do we have anyone upstairs?" she demanded. The auditors around her shook their heads. Ignore this notice had produced too much confusion. "Then someone is coming down," said Miss Tangerine. "They are out of place. They must be stopped."
"We must discuss," an auditor began.
"Do what I say, you organic organ." "It's a matter of personalities," said Lady Le Jean, as Susan pushed open a door in the roof and stepped out onto the leads.
"Yes," said Susan, looking around at the silent city.
"I thought you didn't have them." "They will have them now," said Lady Le Jean, climbing out behind her, "and personalities define themselves in terms of other personalities."
Susan, prowling along the parapet, considered this strange sentence.
"You mean there will be flaming rows?" she said. "Yes, we have never had egos before."
"Well, you seem to be managing."
"Only by becoming completely and utterly insane," said her ladyship.
Susan turned. Lady Le Jean's hat and dress had become even more tattered, and she was shedding sequins. And then there was the matter of the face. An exquisite mask on a bone structure like fine china, which had been made up by a clown. Probably a blind clown. And one who was wearing boxing gloves. In a fog. Lady Le Jean looked at the world through panda eyes, and her lipstick touched her mouth only by accident.
"You don't look insane," lied Susan.
"As such."
"Thank you, but sanity is defined by the majority, I'm afraid. Do you know the saying, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts?"
"Of course." Susan scanned the rooftops for a way down. She did not need this. The thing seemed to want to talk, or rather to chatter aimlessly.
"It is an insane statement. It is a nonsense. But now I believe that it is true."
"Good. That lift should be getting down about now." Slivers of blue light, like trout slipping through a stream, danced around the elevator door. The auditors gathered. They had been learning. Many of them had acquired weapons, and a number of them had taken care not to communicate to the others that gripping something offensive in the hand seemed a very natural thing to do. It spoke to something right down in the back of the brain. It was therefore unfortunate that when a couple of them pulled open the elevator door, it was to reveal, slightly melting in the middle of the floor, a cherry liqueur chocolate. The scent wafted. There was only one survivor, and when Miss Tangerine ate the chocolate, there wasn't even that.
"One of life's little certainties," said Susan, standing on the edge of the museum's parapet, "is that there is generally a last chocolate hidden in all those empty wrappers."
Then she reached down and grabbed the top of a drainpipe. She wasn't certain how this would work. If she fell, but would she fall? There was no time to fall. She had her own personal time. In theory, if anything so definite as a theory existed in a case like this, that meant she could just drift down to the ground. But the time to test a theory like that was when you had no other choice. A theory was just an idea, but a drainpipe was a fact. The blue light flickered around her hands.
"Lobsang," she said quietly, "it is you, isn't it?
That name is as good as any for us."
The voice was as faint as a breath. This may seem a stupid question, but where are you?
We are just a memory. And I am weak.
Oh. Susan slid a little further.
But I will grow strong. Get to the clock.
What's the point? There was nothing we could do.
Times have changed.
Susan reached the ground. Lady Lejeune followed, moving clumsily. Her evening dress had acquired several more tears.
Can I offer a fashion tip? Said Susan.
It would be welcomed, said her ladyship politely.
Long cerise bloomers with that dress? Not a good idea.
No, they are very colourful and quite warm. What should I have chosen instead?
With that cut, practically nothing.
That would have been acceptable.
Susan blanched at unfolding the complex laws of lingerie to someone who wasn't even, she felt, anybody.
To anyone likely to find out, yes, she finished. It would take too long to explain.
Lady Lejeune sighed.
All of it does, she said. Even clothing. Skin substitutes to preserve body heat, so simple, so easy to say. But there are so many rules and exceptions, impossible to understand.
Susan looked along Broadway. It was thick with silent traffic, but there was no sign of an auditor. We'll run into more of them, she said aloud.
Yes, there will be hundreds at least, said Lady Lejeune.
Why?
Because we have always wondered what life is like.
Then let's get up into Zephyr Street, said Susan.
What is there for us?
Wienrich and Bircher.
Who are they?
I think the original Herr Wienrich and Frau Bircher died a long time ago. But the shop still does very good business, said Susan, darting across the street.
We need ammunition.
Lady Lejeune caught up.
Oh, they make chocolate, she said.
There's a bear poo in the woods, said Susan, and realized her mistake straight away. Teaching small children for any length of time can do this to a vocabulary. Too late. Lady Lejeune looked thoughtful for a moment.
Yes, she said at last. Yes, I believe that most varieties do indeed excrete as you suggest, at least in the temperate zones, but there are several that...
I meant to say that, yes, they make chocolate, said Susan.
Vanity, vanity, thought Lute saying, as the milk cart rattled through the silent city. Ronnie would have been like a god, and people of that stripe don't like hiding. Not really hiding. They like to leave a little clue, some emerald tablet somewhere, some code in some tomb under the desert, something to say to the keen researcher, I was here, and I was great. What else had the first people been afraid of? Night, maybe? Cold? Bears? Winter? Stars? The endless sky? Spiders? Snakes? One another. People had been afraid of so many things. He reached into his pack for the battered copy of The Way and opened it at random. Koan 97. Do unto otters as you would have them do unto you. No real help there. Besides, he'd occasionally been unsure that he'd written that one down properly, although it had certainly worked. He'd always left aquatic mammals well alone, and they had done the same to him. He tried again. Koan 124. It's amazing what you see if you keep your eyes open.
What's the book, monk? Said Ronnie.
I'll just... A little book, said Lutze.
He looked around. The cart was passing a funeral parlour. The owner had invested in a large plate glass window, even though the professional undertaker does not, in truth, have that much to sell that looks good in a window, and they usually make do with dark, sombre drapes and perhaps a tasteful urn.
And the name of the fifth horseman.
Ha!
Said Lutze quietly.
Something funny, monk. Obvious when you come to think about it, said Lutze,
as much to himself as to Ronnie. Then he turned in his seat and stuck out his hand.
Pleased to meet you, he said. Let me guess your name.
And said it.
Susan had been unusually inexact. To call Wienrich and Bircher chocolate makers was like calling Leonard of Querm a decent painter who also tinkered with things. Or Death, not someone you'd want to meet every day. It was accurate, but it didn't tell the whole story. For one thing, they didn't make, they created.
There's an important difference, up to $10 a pound usually. And while their select little shop sold the results, it didn't do anything so crass as to fill the window with them. That would suggest, well, over-eagerness. Generally, W&B had a display of silk and velvet drapes, with, on a small stand, perhaps one of their special pralines, or no more than three of their renowned frosted caramels. There was no price tag. If you had to ask the price of W&B's chocolates, you couldn't afford them. And if you tasted one, and still couldn't afford them, you'd save and scrimp and rob and sell elderly members of your family for just one more of those mouthfuls that fell in love with your tongue and turned your soul to whipped cream. There was a discreet drain in the pavement in case people standing in front of the window drooled too much. Wienrich and Bircher were, naturally, foreigners, and according to Ankh Morpork's Guild of Confectioners, they did not understand the peculiarities of the city's taste buds. Ankh Morpork people, said the guild, were hearty, no-nonsense folk who did not want chocolate that was stuffed with cocoa liquor, and were certainly not effete, la-di-da foreigners who wanted cream in everything. In fact, they actually preferred chocolate made mostly from milk, sugar, suet, hooves, lips, miscellaneous squeezings, rat droppings, plaster, flies, tallow, bits of tree, hair, lint, spiders, and powdered cocoa husks. This meant that according to the food standards of the great chocolate centres in Borogravia and Querm, Ankh Morpork chocolate was formerly classed as cheese, and only escaped through being the wrong colour, being defined as tile grout. Susan allowed herself one of their cheaper boxes per month, and she could easily stop at the first layer if she wanted to. "You needn't come in," she said as she opened the shop door. Rigid customers lined the counter. "Please call me Miriam." "I don't think I..." "Please," said Lady Lejeune meekly. "A name is important." Suddenly, in spite of everything, Susan felt a brief pang of sympathy for the creature. "Oh, very well. Miriam, you needn't come in." "I can stand it." "But I thought chocolate was a raging temptation," said Susan, being firm with herself. "It is." They stared up at the shelves behind the counter. Miriam, said Susan, speaking only some of her thoughts aloud. "From the Ephesian word Mirios, meaning innumerable, and Lejeune is a crude pun of legion." "Oh dear."
"We thought that a name should say what a thing is," said her ladyship, "and there is safety in numbers. I'm sorry."
"Well, these are their basic assortments," said Susan, dismissing the shop display with a wave of her hand. "Let's try the back room. Are you all right?"
"I'm fine, I'm fine," murmured Lady Lejeune, swaying.
"You're not going to pig out on me, are you?"
I know about willpower. The body craves the chocolate, but the mind does not. At least so I tell myself. And it must be true. The mind can overrule the body. Otherwise, what is it for?"
"I've often wondered," said Susan, pushing open another door. "Ah, the magician's cave."
"Magic? They use magic here?"
"Nearly right." Lady Lejeune leaned on the doorframe for support when she saw the tables.
"Oh," she said. "Ah, I can detect sugar, milk, butter, cream, vanilla, hazelnuts, almonds, walnuts, raisins, orange peel, various liqueurs, citrus pectin, strawberries, raspberries, essence of violets, cherries, pineapples, pistachios, oranges, limes, lemons, coffees, cocoa..."
"Nothing there to be frightened of, right?" said Susan, surveying the workshop for useful weaponry. "Cocoa is just a rather bitter bean, after all."
"Yes, but..."
Lady Lejeune clenched her fists, shut her eyes and bared her teeth.
"Put them all together and they make..."
"Steady, steady.
The will can overrule the emotions. The will can overrule the instincts,"
the auditor intoned. "Good, good. Now just work your way up to the bit where it says chocolate, okay?"
"That's the hard one."
In fact, it seemed to Susan, as she walked past the vats and counters, that chocolate lost some of its attraction when you saw it like this. It was the difference between seeing the little heaps of pigment and seeing the whole picture. She selected a syringe that seemed designed to do something intensely personal to female elephants, although she decided that here it was probably used for doing the wiggly bits of decoration. And over here was a small vat of cocoa liquor. She stared around at the trays and trays of fondant, creams, marzipans and caramels. Oh, and here was an entire table of soul cake eggs. But they weren't the hollow-shelled, cardboard-tasting presents for children, oh no. These were the confectionery equivalent of fine, intricate jewellery. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw movement. One of the statue-like workers, bent over her tray of praline dreams, was shifting almost imperceptibly. Time was flowing into the room. Pale blue light glinted in the air. She turned and saw a vaguely human figure hovering beside her. It was featureless and as transparent as mist, but in her head it said, "I'm stronger. You are my anchor, my link to this world. Can you guess how hard it is to find it again in so many? Get me to the clock." Susan turned and thrust the icing syringe into the arms of groaning Miria. "Grab that and make some kind of sling or something. I want you to be carrying as many of those chocolate eggs as possible, and the creams, and the liqueurs, understand? You can do it." Oh, gods, there was no alternative. The poor thing needed some kind of morale boost. "Please, Miria. And that's a stupid name. You're not many, you're one, okay? Just be yourself. Unity. That'd be a good name." The new Unity raised a mascara-streaked face. "Yes, it is. It's a good name." Susan snatched as much merchandise as she could carry, aware of some rustling behind her, and turned to find Unity standing to attention, holding by the look of it a bench worth of assorted confectionery in a sort of big cerise sack. "Oh, good. Intelligence use of the materials to hand," said Susan weakly. Then the teacher within her cut in and added, "I hope you brought enough for everybody."